You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.
Thank you. stricken by a thunderbolt from Zeus himself. And he turned and tottered back over to his seat and sat down. By this time, the rest of the audience was screaming at my colleague, "Question! Question! Question!" Get to the question. Get to the point. But he was not fazed. And he made them sit there and listen to it and pay close attention to what it was they were paying to have done. What was included in what little profit they got. Because as shareholders, they were getting something like a quarter of a penny a share, if that. And we got done, and we packed up, and we walked out. But not before we got an answer, I in translation, my colleague in French, of course. And the response of Société Générale was that, no, they most assuredly did not finance mountaintop removal, and could not, and would not financially support companies that ever did such a thing. They were, in a word, lying. Because we had the data. BankTrack follows the money and does it very, very well. And so that bank, as well as Credit Agricole's association with companies like Alpha Natural Resources and formerly Massey and Consol Energy and Arch Coal and Patriot and Peabody and the usual suspects, was as plain as day. So that was pretty much the end of the work day in Paris, and we exited the hall. Both of these Parisian bank shareholder meetings were held in I don't know what else to call them, bunkers. They were held in vast underground auditoriums that went 2-3 levels below the earth. I thought it a bit strange. They were both set up in the same fashion with the same phalanx of beautiful young women backed by the burly guys with things coming out of their ears. But at least there weren't any weapons on display. So we finished up and caught a cab over to my departure point, because in order to get to Frankfurt, I was going to have to... Who knew? You can't go by rail, or at least not that time of day, from Paris to Frankfurt, Germany. Instead, I would have to board a train in Paris. Ooh, a train! Board a train in Paris and head north to Brussels, where I would put up for the night, and the following morning get back aboard a different train and go from Brussels to Frankfurt via places like Liège, Aachen, Cologne. Been working on the accent while I was gone, can't you tell? And the train left from Gare du Nord, a very old and revered train station. It was at the plaza in front of Gare du Nord that thousands of Parisians gathered in 1914 to cheer the arrival of English General Sir John French upon his arrival there to confer with folks like General Joffre, as well as Foch, Clemenceau, it was cheering that was not necessarily deserved. But the one thing for somebody like me walking in a place like that, I saw L'Arc de Triomphe at a great distance during the cab ride, as well as the Eiffel Tower, but that was as close as I got. No Tuileries, no walk around inside the Louvre, none of that. Just Paris on the streets. And it is a magical place. It is most assuredly a magical place. And I'd love to have time to walk around a little bit. But this was a working trip, and not a tourist escapade. So, Renac got me aboard a high-speed train bound for Brussels. Take about 2 hours for the ride. And there at boarding the train there at Gare du Nord, I couldn't help but think of something from about 90 years before, when a pair of newlyweds, Ernest and Hadley Hemingway, had been there. No, I think Hadley was by herself, because she was going to meet Ernest somewhere. And he had in his briefcase everything that he, as a young man, had written to that date. His entire collected works, as of, 1923, 1922. And young Mrs. Hemingway left that briefcase on a station platform in that same Victorian train station where I was. History's all around you, if one only is aware of it. But I and my backpack, more on that later, and my suitcase got aboard the train. Talis is the name of the company. And soon enough, with the sun setting on the French countryside, we were northbound, and I was peering out the windows and just sort of trying to, and I know there's some kind of hokum involved with this, but trying to tap into where I was and looking at all of that land out there, all that flat, flat land. I would see more flat, flat land and some rolling hills and so forth. And suddenly you understand, more so than you do simply by reading books, why Europe has been the blood-soaked place that it historically has been. The very land itself begs conflict. Where those farmlands stand is also the kind of thing that, a cavalry general looks at and says, my oh my, wouldn't it be fun to send our saber-bearing young men horseback flying across this land to clash with some... I mean, everything, Crécy, Agincourt, all the way up to 1914 and 1940. And it was, as Genesis says, of the aftermath of Cain slaying Abel, as if the very blood in the ground cried out. And that's me. And I was exhausted. We were probably crawling up past 40 hours with no sleep at that point. I'm glad you like it, Jack. Nose cone camera view in a plane sounds very cool. I've never heard of that being available before, nor had I. And I got to watch it land too, because it switched back over, and that was neat. Except for the part where the plane felt like it went up off one set of wheels and sort of listed hard to port and then sat back down on them. Got kind of sideways with a little bit of wind shear or something. I don't know. Dr. John noting, with regard to what I said about the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel a little bit back, he says, the paper was one of the biggest remaining employee-owned newspapers up until this year when it announced plans to restructure as a publicly traded company. It instantly started cutting costs, no more home delivery in the hinterlands and so forth, to raise its profit margins, previously around 14%, to reach the Wall Street-approved 21% range. Its IPO is scheduled for fall of this year. Thus, says Dr. John, it is not so much of a stretch to imagine this endorsement of Walker is part of a strategy to make the paper palatable to the 1%, is it? Layoffs, he notes, surely are coming. And I wouldn't be in the least surprised. But that explains, yeah, it really does kind of explain the endorsement of Walker, doesn't it? But the train zipped on ever so comfortably, quietly, with none of the clackada, 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 clackada that you get riding Amtrak, or at least I've experienced. None of those ka-whomp moments where the springs of the car bottom out on a crossing. No pulling off to a siding to let a 125-car train loaded with coal pass in the night. No, by God, we were going to Brussels, and we were going there in a hurry. Every bit of 300 kilometers an hour at one point. And we got to Brussels. And I had sort of dozed off, catnapped a little bit on the train. And I got I got out through the station platform and into the train station. Walked past a couple of Brussels police officers. And 20 feet past them, walked out into the Brussels night. It was midnight. Gare midi in Brussels. Whereupon, from seemingly out of nowhere, an individual whose face I can still see, a young man, was up behind me, blotting at my jacket, telling me I had a stain. And I knew immediately that I was in the middle of one of those 1970s Carl Malden American Express commercials, you know, where the couple gets all their cash disappeared, and then Carl Malden and his nose appear back on screen and says, "You've just been robbed on vacation. What will you do? What will you do?" And goes on to explain about the glories of American Express traveler's checks back in the 70s. Carl Malden had come back into vogue with his role opposite Michael Douglas in The Streets of San Francisco on ABC. And there I was in the middle of it. You know, I was a perfect target. Alone, late, pulling a suitcase, whose wheels by this time had pretty much burned off on the Paris pavement. And with my backpack on my shoulder. Well, I knew this cat was up to no good. I mean, it's not like stopping in traffic and having a guy come out wanting to wash your windows. And so I immediately went to protect the two most important things on my person, my wallet and my passport. I had the backpack on over my shoulder on one strap. And when I spun to confront him, the centrifugal force of this rather heavy backpack, because it had a laptop computer, a broadcast interface, because I'd planned on doing some podcasting over there, a microphone, all my medications, it was heavy. I said more on that later, but It had my in-ear monitors that I used during the show in it. And when I spun to get this guy away from me, the centrifugal force pulled the backpack, basically strap off my shoulder, down to my wrist, where they grabbed it and were gone. It's kind of my, and I was like, shit. And the guy's colleague was the one who had grabbed the bag, while the little dude went skipping off down Place de la Horta. Yeah, there's our Star Trek reference for the night. Apparently he was some sort of highfalutin Belgian architect. But we Trekkies understand that Horta has an entirely different meaning. Couldn't chase him. And I will never forget to this day or far into the future, the unforgettable sight of this little pissant skipping away from me into the Brussels night. Well, I had just walked past a pair of Belgian police officers. Brussels police. I don't know, train station police. No, they were Brussels police. And they were still standing there, staring at me. And I turned around and walked up to them and said, "Parlez-vous anglais?" To which one officer said, "Yes." And I said, "I have been robbed. He's running away right now if you'll go get him." And he said, "You will have to file a report in the morning. The office opens at 7, and that is when the police officer who takes reports in English arrives." And I said, but he's not 2 blocks away if you go chase him." "I cannot fill out this report as I only speak a little English." I was understanding every word. I said, "But my train leaves at 6:30 in the morning. I can't come in at 7. "Ah, that is too bad for you." This is the downside of being an American. Little dude in Chuck Taylors and skinny jeans and a pullover sweatshirt. And in that moment, this is the sociological portion of the program. In that moment, I understood how so many good intentions go wrong. I knew I was going to be getting to Brussels at midnight. I knew I was going to be leaving Brussels at 6. But still, you know, I always wanted to see Belgium too. Often on this program, I've remarked about the fact that Belgium is the Disneyland of beer. It is the land of the historic early resistance of King Albert and the Belgian army to the onslaught of the German army executing the von Schlieffen plan in 1914. Waterloo is in Belgium, is it not? And suddenly, in an instant, I did not care if the entire nation of Belgium went up in flames. Because I was okay. I hadn't been hurt. Theft was on his mind. I think I probably would have gotten in trouble if I'd turned around and tried to get all Dirty Harry on him or anything. Thrown a punch or whatever. Hell no, Marty. I was sober as a judge. I didn't dare. I'd had too much work to do. But, and this was stuff that I ruminated on after I got over to my hotel. It was only a block or so away. And I went, having been effectively ignored by the Brussels police. I dragged the giant suitcase, no longer encumbered by the heavy backpack. I dragged the giant suitcase with me over to Hotel de France. You can look at that. I wouldn't stay there if I were you. Rather a dodgy place. I suppose I will never get used to European ideas of what a hoteliery is. But I got there, and there were compounding problems here. You know, Agnes just walked in the room, and the heavens opened up, and it started pouring and lightning and thundering outside.
That's because you're talking about the skipping Belgium again, Bob.
Yes, the skipping Belgium.
Did I just shake my head?
No, but it was serious, because most important of all, I mean, it all. I mean, you know, my camera was in there, the video camera was in there, and it all tallies out to being about a $2,500 loss. But these are things that can be replaced. But the other problem was that I had my cell phone was not in my bag, and it had about 18% of its battery remaining, and the bag did have my charger in it. So until sometime the next day, I had 18% of a battery to use for internet access, et cetera, calling home, whatever. So I got settled into the hotel room, and by then it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, 7 o'clock back here at home. I called Agnes immediately and told her what had happened, and then got to thinking, holy crap, my data. And see, that's one of those 21st century things that you think about, my God, my data. And used a little bit more of the waning percentages on that phone to reconfer with Agnes and start changing passwords like crazy. Now, meanwhile, I hadn't had my blood pressure medicine in something like 2 days because of the time shift, and you don't want to screw all that up. I hadn't had it since Monday morning. It was now early on Wednesday. And with the stress of the whole event, my blood pressure was probably somewhere around Avogadro's number. I mean, you can feel it when it gets up high enough to be bad. Head was aching, you know, red in the face. Heart was racing. And at that point in time, and I'm not trying to be panicky or anything, I thought to myself, you know, I don't want to die alone in a seedy hotel in Brussels. But Agnes worked on this end, and I worked on my end. And we got that all sort of squared away, and I made sure that she knew that I was okay. And then I just sat back, sort of wait for the morning. And I, as I've mentioned before, I've been journaling rather seriously for several months now. And I had my journal with me, and it wasn't in my backpack, and the little bastard had not stolen it. And like I said, I had this little epiphany. And if there's any, you know me, I'll try to learn from anything. And so I sat there with my journal open and my crappy little pen, because my good pen had been in the backpack that the little Belgian bastard had stolen. He is henceforth and ever... I don't know. Shall we just refer to him as the LBB, the little Belgian bastard? Yeah, see, at that moment in time, like I said, I didn't care if the whole nation of Belgium went up in flames. Good, bad... And it was a really frustrating realization for me, because it was a challenge to everything that I believe and hold dear and hold true in my own existence. But, yeah, and since then, Belgium has become anathema. There will be no Belgian beers in this home. Hell, Agnes has declared interdit on the Brussels sprouts. I wanted to bring her something home, and I checked in at one of the shops in Amsterdam in the airport there, and all the damn chocolate was Belgian, and I knew better than to do that because she'd already declared war. God help those poor people if she ever gets over there. But I sat there and had this moment of understanding. Because, you know, white folks went on this conquest kick that lasted about 400 years. And the tales are rife of newly discovered lands in which the white folks bringing Christianity and civilization to the heathen savages go ashore. And quite often their commanders said things like, you know, let's get along with these people. We're a long way from home. We don't want to make enemies out of these folks. We'd like to live to tell the story of this, our adventure. And they began interacting with the natives, and sooner or later, something goes sideways, and one of the natives runs off with a helmet or a knife or a cup or a glass bead or something, and then, you know, the white folks open fire with their muskets and the slaughter is on. That's basically the entire history of the settlement of North and South America, really, when you get right down to it. And you read about it in the history books, and you think, it didn't have to be that way. Couldn't they? Oh, if only they'd been a little bit more enlightened. If only they'd held their fire. If only they'd realized that they were dealing with situations that they didn't fully understand. That there were cross currents within the cultural clash, and there I was. Because I was, and I could pull my journal out right now and read you the entry that I wrote. History geek that I am, I sat in that hotel room. Oh, by the way, yeah, he got my cigarettes, too. I know, the non-smoking people. Oh, it's a damn shame you hadn't quit. Well, I'm a junkie. He was a junkie, and I'm a junkie. My junk is nicotine. And so I was sitting there looking at the very last of my cigarettes. And in a state of rather high dudgeon, kind of lighting one after the other. And writing, scribbling furiously and contemplating history and thinking back all the way to Julius Caesar. And I said earlier that I cherish my teachers. And it wasn't just Madame Williams and her French 1 and 2. It was Miss Bethke and her Latin 1, 2, and 3 and those maps of Gaul with the little dotted lines on them from Caesar's Gallic Wars that showed where the tribes lived, and up in a northern, northwesterly chunk of Europe were some dotted lines that said Belgae. If I recall my Caesar correctly, they were rather ferocious warriors. Caused him no small amount of trouble. And Caesar slaughtered them in their tens of thousands. And I, peace-loving, nonviolent Bob Kincaid, sat on a hotel bedroom in Brussels, Belgium, furious at myself, at that junkie, at those useless Belgian police, and the first thing that came into my mind was, Gaius, oh Gaius, you missed a couple. Because their thousandth generation later grandson junkie just stole my backpack with my meds in it. You didn't finish the job, Caesar. And in that moment, I had that sort of epiphany understanding how even good intentions can go south in the midst of a rotten circumstance. I was dressed in a pair of khakis and a dress shirt and a tie and a navy blue blazer, the same thing I had worn at the two bank meetings previously in the day. And I realized that more than just looking like a victim, I may damned well have looked like a member of the 1%. Because I sure wasn't going to walk into those meetings wearing my overalls and putting on my hee-haw act. No, you don't do that. But in that moment of extreme stress and extreme fury, that little epiphany came. But I'm still mad at the Belgians. Agnes tells me that she had a sight. And it was really weird because I did not describe the LBB to her. She described him to me, which was weird because I don't go in for that whole read the book kind of stuff. But I'm learning. When Agnes tells me things, it's only taken 19 years, but I pay attention. She told me that when they didn't find any money in the bag, that they chucked everything but the bag of meds, and told me that our LBB went off and OD'd himself. Do I know that to be true? No, I don't. But in light of the fact that she had described him down to a T, who am I to know? But I do know that, for instance, I was able to remotely shut down, wipe, and lock one of the devices. And it has never to this moment, and it will be 2 weeks tomorrow, been turned on. It's not been powered up. Because the minute that it got access to a Wi-Fi signal, it would lock itself down and wipe itself. Interesting, huh? But yeah, my fascination with Belgium is pretty much done.
In today's modern galaxy, there is, of course, very little still held to be unspeakable. Many words and expressions, which only a matter of decades ago were considered so distastefully explicit that, were they merely to be breathed in public, the perpetrator would be shunned, barred from polite society, and in extreme cases shot through the lungs, are now thought to be very healthy and proper, and their use in everyday speech is seen as evidence of a well-adjusted, relaxed, and totally un-f***ed up personality. So, for instance, when in a recent national speech the financial minister of the Royal World Estate of Qual Vista actually dared to say that due to one thing and another, and the fact that no one had made any food for a while, and that the king seemed to have died, and that most of the population had been on holiday now for over 3 years, the economy had now arrived at what he called one whole juju flop situation, everyone was so pleased he felt able to come out and say it, that they quite failed to notice that their 5,000-year-old civilization had just collapsed overnight. But though even words like juju flop, swat, and turlingdrome are now perfectly acceptable in common usage, there is one word that is still beyond the pale. The concept it embodies is so revolting that the publication or broadcast of the word is utterly forbidden in all parts of the galaxy except one, where they don't know what it means. That word is Belgium.
Precisely. Thanks to our buddy Horst for sending that clip along. Some of this I kind of tweeted at and Facebooked about in a roundabout way. But suffice to say, well, I mean, is it okay if I just do this whole travel log kind of thing? I haven't been able to talk to anybody. I've talked to a lot of people. Jesus, I've talked to thousands of people at a time. But to tell the story, no. So I hope you're not just, you know, falling asleep and reaching for the no-dos or anything. So with the battery going low down past 7% on the phone and not trusting it to have battery power to power the alarm at 5 a.m. when I needed to be up and out and headed back the block and a half, 2 blocks of the train station, where at this point in time, for all I knew, the LP was going to come after the suitcase, too. And not trusting the kind of skeedy-looking guy who looked like something out of a dystopian movie who was the desk clerk. I more or less sat awake until it was and wrote and just journaled about all of this that I've been talking about until 5 o'clock came around. In the meantime, I'd showered and tidied up as best I could, and didn't put the and dressed in distinctly non 1% fashion. That is, I kept the jacket and the tie tucked away. And went down and went back and waited nervously in Gare Midi for the train to Frankfurt, where I had no doubt I would not be dealing with such eventualities. And I didn't. I got aboard a high-speed train run by Deutsche Bahn that went from Brussels to Liège to Aachen to Cologne and on to Frankfurt at, again, that magnificent 300 kilometers per hour. And sat down, and the man sitting opposite me was an old African gentleman who looked about as comfortable as I felt, i.e. not. And since my main journal was tucked away in my remaining suitcase, I had my little pocket journal with me, and I got my pen out and began to write. And pretty soon the beverage cart came around. And at this point, I was kind of desperate to restore something of my general optimism in about humanity. The old gentleman opposite whom I sat and I had engaged in a little conversation in a colonial French accent. He asked me in English whether I was German or American. I answered in my 33-year-old French that I was American. He nodded his head and smiled and said, "Good, good." Didn't know why. He explained to me that he was from Cameroon and that he had come to Paris, was on to Germany, to sell antiquities. And in light of my ruminations of a few hours before in the seedy hotel room in Brussels, it seems like It seemed like things were conspiring just to teach lessons. And I sat there opposite him as he took slick photo paper prints out of his briefcase and showed me photographs of obviously African carvings of elephants and the other local fauna. And he pointed to them and said, "Very old, very old. I sell." And he didn't look or act in any wise like what you would expect an antiquities smuggler or hustler to act like. And the first thing that came into my mind was, my God, here comes somebody else to sell off their patrimony to the grubbing and grabbing 1%. And I pointed to his photographs and I said, "C'est magnifique." And he nodded and smiled and said, "Ah, oui." And about that time, the beverage cart came around. And I ordered a cup of decaf. They do speak decaf. And it was merciful at that point in my life. And the attendant turned to the gentleman opposite me and said, asked him if he'd like anything. And he sort of shook his head and smiled a little half smile and said, "No, no." And in that moment, I looked at him. I just looked up and I didn't like the idea of sitting there drinking coffee opposite him with him not having anything, and said, "What'll you have?" And looked at the attendant and said, "Whatever he wants." And he looked at me sort of unbelieving and smiled. A big, huge, beautiful smile. And in that accent that I can't even begin to approach, simply said, "Ah, merci, monsieur, merci, mon ami." And looked at the attendant and said, simply, "Hey." Ordered it with a little bit of cream. And we sat there, I with my coffee and he with his tea, and conversed as best we could. Him talking about being anxious to get home to Cameroon. Talking about his antiquities. And at Cologne, he got off the train. And I think I was, at least in some small degree, restored. Restoration was not, however, complete. That was yet to come. But I guess that sort of closed out the francophonic portion of the initial days of the journey. In the course of my conversation with my host in Paris, we had talked about musical taste, and he'd talked about hosting some radio, and I told him what I did. And he said, I told him about my family back at home. He said, I told him they were teenagers. He said, "Do your children like hip-hop?" And I said, "Yes, because they do." And he said, "I will send them some good French, socially aware hip-hop." And today, he did. This is, lucky for me, it comes with a translation. It's from a group called NTM. It's a song called Qu'est-ce qu'on attend? which I don't fully understand the translation of, but I think I get the gist. So I've managed to filibobster for an hour and 28 minutes now, and we aren't anywhere near done. And we'll get on to the German side of the Odyssey after we take a little break. And no, this will not be Edith Piaf singing La Vie en Rose, or Grace Jones singing it, or anybody singing La Vie en Rose. No, this is NTM. Qu'est-ce que qu'on attend? Pretty intense.
Les années passent, on s'en soucie toujours à sa place. Plus de bitume donc, encore moins d'espace. Plus tard, il est nécessaire à l'équilibre de l'homme. Non, personne n'est plus discriminé, tout comme c'est comme de nous dire que la France avance alors qu'elle pense par la répression sauf pénètre la délinquance. S'il vous plaît, un peu de bon sens, les cons ne régleront pas l'état d'urgence. À coup sûr, ce qui m'amène à me demander combien de temps tout ceci va encore durer. Déjà les années que tout aurait dû péter Thomas, que l'unité n'est pété de notre côté. Mais vous savez que ça va finir mal. Que ça, la guerre des mondes, vous l'avez voulu, la voilà. Mais qu'est-ce qu'on attend pour se faire? Mais qu'est-ce qu'on attend pour ne plus suivre les règles du jeu? Mais qu'est-ce qu'on attend pour se faire? Mais qu'est-ce qu'on attend pour se faire? Mais qu'est-ce qu'on attend pour se faire?
Comme le veut la société, il n'est temps que cela cesse. On passe face à l'allégresse pour que notre jeunesse et même un vengeuresse connaissez en premier aide. On voit la république se brûler, on l'a même touché. Notre tour est venu à nous de chasser les dés. Décidez donc, on mentalement de cesse de faire quoi. Tes neurones, tu vois pas, tu fais semblant, tu m'entends pas. Je crois que tu te fais, tu t'accordes pas vraiment le choix. Beaucoup sont déjà dans ce cas. Voilà pourquoi cela finira dans le désarroi.
Désarroi, désarroi.
Le monde ira dans l'existence.
Désarroi,
désarroi. Tu dirais la même chose. Venu l'homme, c'est pourquoi j'en attends donc. Putain de politique d'incompétence. Ce qui a diminué la France. Faut faire ne plus à l'indulgence, mais t'en fais par le feu, ça qui a mis, sans mettre le mieux. Faut qu'on nous prenne un peu plus, un peu plus en sérieux.
Mais qu'est-ce qu'on attend pour se faire?
You know, that's the thing. It's not the disaffected, disenchanted young people in France or Germany who are blowing up mountains in Appalachia, who are pillaging everything on the planet that they can get their hands on. No, hell no! It's well-heeled, well-spoken, well-educated one-percenters in bespoke suits that are doing the piracy. What are we waiting for? This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is an epic filibobster on a Monday night. Mondays, you know, are ordinarily Moran Mondays, but not so much tonight. I've been absolutely going wild waiting to tell the story of this whole long journey. And to people who go back and forth across various oceans, I'm sure some of it seems terribly, terribly simplistic, but it wasn't for me. It was not for me. I rode on that Deutsche Bahn train and arrived in Frankfurt on time to the dot. The stations being called out by the conductress, you know, chipper, joyous voice that got happier with each changing language, French, German, Flemish, and English. Until we arrived perfectly on time, and down one backpack, I got the mammoth suitcase with the wheels burned off of it, and dragged it off the station platform and met my Urgewald contact there in the station. Who then guided me through the Frankfurt rail system and over to the meeting of Commerzbank. It was by then an absolutely sunny and lovely day in Germany's financial center. And at the venue where the annual general meeting was taking place, filled literally with thousands of shareholders, I was met by the people who would be my colleagues for the next several days. And a lot was on my mind, because by then I had found out from Agnes that our eldest daughter was still quite sick, and is still quite sick, and was not sure even at that time if I was going to have to figure out a way to get home early. I didn't, and she continues to hopefully recover. But I was met there by the wonderful team of folks from Urgewald who would guide me through the process, and was shown around the event space, and a little bit of the culture was explained to me, that many of the shareholders of these banks are older folks who show up for the rather nice spread that the bank puts out for its shareholders. And it was nice indeed. Commerzbank goes all out and puts on a very nice meeting. But that doesn't much matter, or it didn't much matter to me, when in fact the fact remained that nice spread or no, nice event space or no, that bank was financing the blasting, plundering, pillaging, and destruction of my home and the futures of my children and children as yet undreamt of and unborn. Really, I was really beginning to, I don't know, I'm pretty proud of the fact. I was holding up pretty doggone good for zero sleep and all that stress, and my new colleagues inquired as to my well-being, and if I was going to be okay without the meds for a while. I said, oh yeah, I'll be fine. And they said, well, we'll get this taken care of. And I'm thinking, how? But you trust your new friends, and what magnificent new friends they were. Katrin and Marietta and Birta. And they guided me through the entire process until, and there's a photograph that was on my Facebook page that was caught by one of the other folks, a man by the name of Eitan, who came from Indonesia because Commerzbank is financing the destruction of his home too. He held up a photo during his presentation, and I looked up, and it was all projected on giant screens around the room. I looked up and went, damn, that's mountaintop removal. But it wasn't. It was mountaintop removal without the mountaintop, or without the mountain. But it was the same filthy, cancerous scar upon the land that these extraction industries, these 1% driven extraction industries, impose upon indigenous peoples wherever they think there is a bit of profit to be gouged out of the ground. And he happened to bring his camera with him, and he caught a picture of Birta and I giving our presentation. It's there on my Facebook page if you want to go look. I think it might also be on my Twitter stream. At some point, it will probably find its way onto the horn, knowing the posting magic that News Ninja Susan so often does. But we gave that presentation, and again, the answer came, oh, we don't do that. Oh, we would never do such a thing. But when we got done with our presentation, as was the case with my new friend Eitan as well, the crowd gave out an ovation. And that much was gratifying, even if the directors didn't much care for it. One got the sense that crowd of shareholders did not much care for the directors themselves. But we told them the same thing that we had told the two French banks. We told them that there are a growing mass of peer-reviewed scientific studies, the same studies you and I have talked about night after night here, and that they document that mountaintop removal is poisoning and killing the people of an entire region of this country. I suppose the directors of Commerzbank were no more interested in hearing truth spoken to power than I guess the 1% ever are. Oh, News Ninja Susan just told me via email that picture is already up there at the website. Thank you, Susan. See what I mean? Isn't this awesome? But at the final bank meeting we would attend, the outrageous lying would become even more profound. We'll get to that. Jack in Shreveport writing in says, under the email heading, "They want it all." He says, seems like time to think about what you've stated many times before. Why can't they take the billions they already have and just go off to spend more time with their families? Says Jack, it's some kind of sociopathy. And it really, really is. This seemingly intractable urge to acquire and acquire and acquire. Well, it goes back to that line from Chinatown. That line uttered by Jack Nicholson.
Why are you doing it? How much better can you eat? What can you buy that you can't already afford?
Really? And I don't even know if these 1% predators can explain it. Acquisition and pillaging is what they do, and I don't know if they would know how to do anything else. The magnificent folks at Urgewald deal with issues relating to nuclear power, which is just stupid to finance. But they finance it anyway. They deal with issues of coal extraction, including mountaintop removal, where the coal companies themselves are not profitable. And yet these banks continue to do bond issues and share issues for them and wind up with just shitloads of their stock in the bank's own portfolios. And they hustle them. And they, oh, you want to buy these? You know, these? Oh, well, we've moved these from hold to buy. Buy them. You know, we saw that with the credit default swaps and the derivatives and all of that bubblicious horse shit. And they're still doing it. And they don't know why. Except that they think that somewhere down the road, I don't know, one more lobster for lunch? What? It's just in the nature of what they do. They are Borg, I guess. But we stated our piece, and then I was taken under the wing of two of my new colleagues who said, we're going to go and get your medicine now. They were, I think they were afraid I was going to die or something. I was just exhausted, not dying. But, you know, it's a good idea. Yeah, when you take blood pressure medicine, it's good to keep taking it. When you take that little diabetes pill, it's good to keep taking it. The cholesterol meds are good to take. And so they said, we're going to go get your medicine. And I said, well, okay, come with us. So we left the event space. And once again, I was guided through the, any given city's rapid transit system can be tough enough to figure out, and it becomes about a million times as much so when you don't speak the language. And just as I'd had 2 years of high school French 33 years before, I'd had 1 year of high school German 31 years before. And it wasn't good for much. But, you know, I could, well, like Mark Twain says in The Awful German Language, if you can say two words in German, you'll get by. Zwei Glas. Two glasses of beer. God bless you, Mr. Clemens. That's something I tweeted along the way as well. No matter how annoying the internet can sometimes be, the fact that you can have one of the greatest minds America ever produced and all of the things his mind produced, the entire collected works of Samuel Langhorne Clemens, with you anywhere on the planet because of the internet, well, that's pretty special. And so I had Mr. Clemens's A Tramp Abroad with Me, which detailed his late 1870s visit to Germany. And it was a soothing balm indeed, because it's a little bit frightening to be somewhere you don't speak the language. And in both France and Germany, both, I sat there thinking, oh God, if only, because it's a delight to be able to communicate that way. But no worries. Especially because Europeans have a better view toward, even the French, toward learning English than we Americans have toward learning any other languages. We'll just, you know, we're Americans. If you don't understand us the first time, we'll just yell it louder. ¿Dónde está la tequilería? Right? Lucky for me, they didn't have that attitude. So off we went through the mass transit system of Frankfurt, and detrained, walked a couple of blocks, and lo and behold, it was explained to me that all the doctor's offices are closed in Germany on Wednesday. Doctors get Wednesdays off. I explained that it was quite a common phenomenon here, and that doctors went and it was typically understood that doctors go and play golf on Wednesdays. But, you know, I'm uninsured, and I was twice as uninsured in Germany. And not having a huge pocket full of money to deal with, was not at all confident that this was going to work out well. But Marietta and Birta kept reassuring me, no, it'll be fine. And you know what? It was. Because even though all the doctors are off on Wednesdays, and this was a Wednesday, it turns out that because of that, there are little emergency walk-in doctors all over the country. And they had found the one in Frankfurt, or in a part of Frankfurt, for me. And this is one of those gee-golly moments. Wide-eyed. As I got to watch another country's healthcare system in action. Getting my meds replaced in the United States would have been something approaching Herculean. In this case, however, we walked into the emergency medical clinic or walk-in clinic, explained the situation to the receptionist, who asked me to pay, I think, 10 euros. Euros, I'm still working on that. It's a euro. Which I gladly did, and that covered the office visit. You know, something around 14 bucks. Not to see a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner, but by God, to see a real, live, honest-to-Jesus MD physician. Sat down in one of the chairs in the waiting area, prepared to be there for the rest of the evening. This is the way medicine works here in the land of the free and the home of the brave. And was called back into the doctor's office approximately 3 minutes later. The doctor was a kindly and businesslike fellow who asked me my name, my date of birth, where I was from, showed him my passport just for good measure. And said something like, I'd hate to be in your situation. Let's see if we can't make it better. And proceeds to ask me about the medications. I tell him all of them. And this was a beautiful moment. He fires up his computer and tells me, this will be this much, this will be this much, and this will be this much. I said, something like, is that an average? He said, no. Any pharmacy in Germany you take this to, that's how much this medicine will cost. There's that socialism. Which I was beginning to like. So, all told, paid the money, got the prescriptions, walked across the street to one of the pharmacies. Apotheke. Presented them. They filled a couple, didn't have one, so we just went to another one, because they're all over. And they're not like Rite Aids or Walgreens where they sell umbrellas and rubber boots and the drill presses and, you know, some medicine at the back. These are pharmacies straight out of America's middle-class golden age, post-1950s. It's a little storefront, and they sell medicine. And some herbal remedies. and some wraps for sprained wrists and ankles and braces for bum knees and things like that. And we were in and we were out, and the total outlay for my four medications and the doctor visit came to less than 100 euros for a 90-day supply of each. Still taking it. It would have been hard to match that in the United States, if not impossible. After that, we were off to the middle of Frankfurt, where we found me a phone charger so I could get back in touch with the rest of the world. We went to the local, because it's an iPhone, went to the local Apple store, where, of course, even in Germany, I paid the Apple tax. The little charger to plug into my phone was something on the order of $40. Ouch. But with those things accomplished, well, no, Ron, given as I was in Frankfurt, ich bin ein Berliner would have been out of line. Did you, Bob, after getting your meds, did you say ich bin ein Berliner? No, but I was having real relocation urges, I can tell you that. Because what I'd, even in my state of exhaustion, in the short period of time I'd been in Germany, what I was beginning to recognize was that this was a nation that functioned. I had not seen, nor did I see, in the entire time I was there, any gory billboards talking about what women do with the workings of the insides of their own insides bodies. At all. I did see some other things, and that'll come in a few minutes. But we got all finished up, went and had a bite of dinner under a lovely, warm, approaching evening sky, sidewalk cafe, tree-lined street, Frankfurt. My first meal in Germany was first sit-down dinner in Germany was Thai curry. It was explained to me that the German people are absolutely wild for cuisine from other cultures. And I was like, yeah, but what about the Rouladen, and what about the Wiener Schnitzel, and what about the Sauerbraten, and they went, oh no, not that. But we had a lovely meal. Then we rushed back to the Hauptbahnhof, the central train station there, and boarded a train for Münster, which we reached by about 11 o'clock, just after the last fading light had left the sky. There's a university of some considerable size in Münster, and I'm seeing all these names, and my poor little overworked brain is trying to correlate this with that. And Münster, why do I know Münster? No, it's not about the damn cheese, Bob. What? It would come to me. At Münster, we got off the train, got in the car for the little trip to the little German town where I would spend the remaining time until the next bank meeting, and went driving off down two-lane country German roads that were just beautiful in the night and as smooth as a baby's. Kevin, 100 euros in American money is about anywhere from 130 to 140 bucks. And like I said, my total tab came to about 70. So it was right at 100 bucks. And I was exhausted when we finally got to this magnificent house in the German countryside in a little town, where Urgewald is headquartered, these magnificent people doing this magnificent work. And it's an old country house that goes back about 260 years. Texas Betsy pointing out, yeah, those are Bavarian foods, and that was in, I was informed very quickly that those traditional German foods I'd heard of were in fact Bavarian. We had a big laugh over the, we were talking about beers and such, and I told them that the two German beers one sees the most of in American on American shelves are, of course, Beck's, which is of course the number, the biggest seller in Germany as well, and then St. Pauli Girl. And they looked at me, what? And so I showed them the St. Pauli Girl label, and they laughed. Oh, it was hilarious. Because it turned, you know, St. Pauli Girl comes from Bremen, Germany, but it's got a Munich barmaid on, the, you know, a southern German barmaid, you know, Oktoberfest with the two mugs in her hand. And it became obvious pretty quickly that that was a giant fraud perpetrated upon the mostly 20-something young male imbibers of that brand. Yeah, Ron, me too. He says, I'm waiting, Ron and Raleigh says, what I'm waiting for is the Babelfish. Instantaneous translation without the need to take the time to learn those pesky foreign languages. And if you read Kurt Vonnegut's, and I had Kurt with me too, if you read Kurt Vonnegut's Galapagos, there's a reference in there to an instant translation device, and I can't remember its name. But the same concept, the same concept. So having been shown around this very, very old house, this magnificent house, I was shown to my room where, for the first time in something probably approaching 48 hours, I was allowed to sleep. We got into the town too late for me to really see any of what it looked like, so I didn't have a functioning appreciation for my surroundings. But at about 3 in the morning, and God only knows what time it was in the clock in my head, I got to sleep. And I slept and slept until about noon, which of course was 6 a.m. my time. And that's when the bells started. You know, a lot of people read Edgar Allan Poe's The Bells and think that it sounds kind of crazy. And I've read it the same way too, because it seems a little crazy. He says, "Hear the sledges with the bells, silver bells. What a world of merriment their melody foretells! How they tinkle, tinkle, tinkle in the icy air of night, while the stars that oversprinkle all the heavens seem to twinkle with a crystalline delight, keeping time, time, time in a sort of runic rhyme to the tintinnabulation that so musically wells from the bells, 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 from the jingling and the tinkling of the bells." The second stanza, "Hear the mellow wedding bells, golden bells, what a world of happiness their harmony foretells. Bells, bells." Third verse, "Hear the loud alarm bells, brazen bells, what a tale of terror now their turbulency tells. Bells, 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 bells." Verse 4, "Hear the tolling of the bells, iron bells, what a world of solemn thought their monody compels." You get the idea that he had the bells a little bit too much on his mind, and you tend to think that, maybe E.A. Poe is a little nuts. I tend to think he was merely interrupted from much-needed sleep, or at least that's what the conclusion I reached on that Thursday morning in Nordrhein-Westfalia. Because at noon, the bells of the Roman Catholic Church across the little street from the old house, the beautiful old house where I was staying, began to toll. And okay, it's noon. Give me 12 quick rings and then shut up. That way we all know it's noon. But no, no. They went on and on and on until they worked their way all the way down into my subconscious, where some part of me realized that they weren't stopping anytime soon. And I sort of peeled open my bleary and what felt like bleeding eyes, and they were burning, and I reached over and looked at my phone to see the clock, and it was 12 minutes after 12. I remember distinctly it was 12:12. And the bells were still going, with no sign of ceasing. And I began to think, Jesus Christ, what is this about? And so I got up, pulled my world together, and walked outside and walked out the back door of the house, which I had not seen the night before, and was met with the most majestic vision I think I could have imagined. Save for the fact that those bells were still going, and the first words out of my mouth to an otherwise empty garden space were, Quasimodo's gotta die. I think if I'd had the ability, I would have rocked him. If there was really somebody pulling on those ropes, I would have rocked them out of the tower. Later on, I was informed that if you were particularly faithful, you could pay the church and they would ring the bells more. Remembering an old exchange between Groucho Marx and his brother Chico, talking about a band playing at an event, where Chico says, and if we rehearse, it's $15 more. And Groucho says, what do you get if you don't play? Chico says, well, you can't afford that. Upon being told that you could have the bells rung extra, I said, what does it cost to have them not rung at all? No, you can't afford that. And the bells went on for a solid half hour. And I began to look around the garden. The garden was about 100 yards long and about two-thirds as wide as a football field, with trees that were probably saplings when Columbus landed in the Americas. Beeches and lindens and birches, massive things, and statuary in the garden. Four little cherubs in various states of undress and in various states of activity at the corner right before me, and down to my immediate left, something precious, a rhododendron in full bloom, the state flower of West Virginia. And the mere sight of the rhododendron nearly sent me to tears. There would be a week between that day and the coming Deutsche Bank shareholder meeting. And it was a week that I used to sort of get the ground under my feet again and get my wits about me and try to come to some understanding of where I was and what it meant, and to work on remarks for Deutsche Bank, and to get to know the little town where I was of about 14,000 people. And the weekend upcoming turned out to be a festival weekend. On the Roman Catholic festival feast calendar, We worked it out between the German and the English, my wonderful new colleagues and hosts, that it was the Feast of Pentecost. Some irony in that is a couple of days later I would get stories from several, the same story from several of you, telling me about how a snake-handling preacher in West Virginia had died of a rattlesnake bite. That occasioned some explaining, which I was more than happy to do as a sort of cross-cultural sort of thing. They do what, Bob? Yeah. One gets the idea that those bells ring at the church across the street not so much to call the faithful. I'm always reminded by the line from Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon where they sing, "And far away across the field, the tolling of an iron bell calls the faithful to their knees to hear the softly spoken magic spell." Didn't see a lot of people going in and out of the church. It was more like they were ringing those bells just as a sort of reminder of some sort of fading relevance. But it was the weekend of Pentecost, the festival of Pentecost, and the festival of Pentecost is, of course, Pentecost is the time when the Holy Spirit allegedly descended upon the remaining disciples in the upper room, and they were given the power to cast out demons and speak in tongues and survive snake bite and drink strychnine and crap like that. But it turns out that the festival, the secular side of the festival weekend, embodied a kind of a convention in the space that was a couple of hundred more yards on down past the garden. And it was a convention of marching bands. No, really, marching bands. That just like a high school marching band here in the U.S., only clubs. People that get together and march and play music for the sheer joy of doing it. Their joy if no one else's. And so beginning either late on Thursday or early on Friday, I really can't remember because days were running one into the other. I was astonished. Yes, Country Mouse, gone across the pond. I was astonished to note that full dark wasn't hitting until about 11 p.m., which I thought was really kind of cool. But it also meant that it was kind of hard to go to bed before midnight. But beginning either late Thursday or early Friday, we began to hear the honkings and bleatings of various and sundry marching bands playing. And then come Sunday, they started marching in earnest. And there really was a festival going on down there, and the beer wagons were there, and the food wagons, and I learned about the national craze for Döner, which is like Euro, only Turkish. And one evening I walked down there just to sample the wares. I was in Germany, after all. I was not going to leave without trying the local brew. And I'd gotten a little bit of rest in me and my wits about me. And that's where I had one of these little... It was just one epiphany after another. In the meantime, I'd figured out where I was, and yes, that I was the 22, 23, 24 miles west of Münster, wherein was signed in 1648... the Peace of Westphalia, an equidistant, although in a different direction, from Osnabrück, wherein was also signed another portion of the Peace of Westphalia that ended the 30 Years' War, more or less, and gave rise to the very idea of the nation-state. That we are still debating to this day. I also realized that I was in pretty close proximity to something that's fascinated me for decades, ever since I read about it in Ms. Bethke's Latin class. The site of the Battle of the Teutoburg Forest. The Teutoburger Wald. And the Teutoburg Forest is still there. and they're rolling, they're forested rolling hills, very similar to the low rolling portions of the Appalachians. In nine of the current era, one Quintilius Varro, a brutal Roman governor of Germania Inferior, the young German colony of the Roman Empire, marched himself into a trap. A man by the name of Arminius, who had been held hostage, and when the Romans held hostage, that meant they took your kid, took him to Rome, educated him, taught him how to be a Roman. Taught him Roman military tactics, the whole works. And Arminius was kept there until he was a young man. He was inducted into the equites, the equestrian class. He had full Roman citizenship. He had all the schooling a young Roman could have. And the Romans saw this as a means of civilizing the barbarians. Arminius was then sent home to Germany, where he was supposed to share his civilizing ways with his fellow Teutonic tribesmen. Although it wasn't the Teutones, I forget the tribe. Well, Arminius didn't. Instead, the entire time that he was being educated in Rome, he harbored a seething hatred for the Romans. And upon being sent back to Germany, he was seconded to the staff of the governor, Quintilius Varro, who had basically one method of dealing with problems among the locals. Crucifixion. You know, the Christians do tend to forget that the Romans used crucifixion more than three times. They think that Christian martyrs were the only ones who were persecuted, and they think that that happened in the Colosseum. Well, it didn't. Atne ute aipre, if you own a way, ime. But Arminius sat there quietly, being a great friend of Quintilius Varro, governor and general, and silently went about the business of building a rebellion against the Romans. And eventually led the tribes together using good Roman military tactics, and slaughtered almost to the last man three full Roman legions. The 17th, the 18th, and the 19th, I believe. Either 16, 17, 18, or 17, 18, 19. Suetonius, in his Lives of the 12 Caesars, reports to us that upon receiving word of the slaughter of the three legions, something in excess of 20,000 Roman citizen soldiers, that Caesar Augustus literally banged his head against the walls of the palace back in Rome, screaming, "Quintilivare legiones rede." Quintilius Varro, give me back my legions. And right there, in nine of the current era, the history and face of Europe met a crossroads and was forever changed. The language of the Gauls, whatever it was, would eventually be subsumed underneath a colloquialized form of Latin that we recognize as early Proto-French and is in fact French today. Because Arminius stopped the Romans in the Teutoburg Forest, that same enculturation did not take place, did not happen, because the Romans more or less gave up on ever colonizing Germany across the Rhine. And there is a great monument there, not far from Detmold, called the Hermann's Denkmal. It sits on the highest point in the Teutoburg Forest and is a giant statue cast in bronze? The same thing as the Statue of Liberty. Of an imagined Arminius, whom they went on to rename Hermann, holding aloft a sword and wearing a helmet with eagle's wings on the sides. It was dedicated in the 1870s, 1875, I believe, and became a source of national pride. A couple of generations later, some rather nasty gatherings would be held there as well, and to this day, it remains a place near and dear in the heart of Nazis. Nasty little bastards. I hate them worse than that LBB. We visited the area of the statue. We'd hoped to go on and see the further evidence of the battle, but time ran short. Walking up the hill to the site of the monument, lo and behold, there they were. They look like the same no matter where you go, or at least in the United States and Germany, possibly other European nations. They look the same. Godforsaken, freakish, little, dumbass, skinhead, white supremacist, whatever you want to call them. In this case, about five of them, drunk off their ass, up in the park, wearing their black T-shirts with the number 88 on it. Oh, how cute. Drunk little young Nazis. Because they're there. And they're on the rise. And it's disturbing. But back for a moment to that little epiphany I had, the difference between there and here. And you know, we don't necessarily measure them all in macro terms. Some we measure in micro. And I walked down to the little festival there, the Pentecost festival that featured the marching bands. And if you've ever been far, far from home and heard a song played that struck you right in the heart, you'll know what I'm talking about. I was sitting in the garden when, lo and behold, it was Friday or Saturday, I don't know what day. Lo and behold, sitting in that garden, it was as though an arrow had pierced my heart, because one of those marching bands in the distance, these little local clubs that play and march for the joy of it, began sawing away at Take Me Home Country Roads. I almost stood up. I was absolutely powerless. Tears welled up in my eyes. It was not the last time that would happen. This was, after all, Memorial Day weekend. In the United States, it was Memorial Day weekend. But I had to explain that was the unofficial anthem of West Virginia. Kind of mind-boggling. There were lots of those moments. And I'm utterly unsuited to try to explain them. But I had walked down to this little festival. I thought I would try the local brew, because I heard there was a beer cart down there. Try, not swill. Thought I would try the local brew. And I got down there and got myself amazed. For there in this lovely little green space with a bandstand, and it turned out that the disco would crank up at 10 p.m. and go till about 3, playing really, really, really bad, bad. It wasn't techno, it wasn't trance, it wasn't disco, it was just bad. With a DJ who was quite full of himself. But it was a charming little space, and the beer wagon was there. And anytime you go to a festival anywhere in the U.S., at least the festivals I've been to, You know, if they're serving beer, they serve it in plastic cups. And after not too long, the garbage cans are overflowing with plastic cups. And plastic cups litter the ground, and stale, stinking beer is all over creation. Well, not so. No, the beer wagons had gotten there. They'd hooked up to the local public water and public sewer supply, and they had onboard dishwashers. Every garbage can in every street was segregated into paper and plastic and glass or metal so that recycling happened without a second thought. Marty, what was I doing going to an Apple store to buy a charger? Well, Marty says, go third party. I'm certain they have wireless access. No, they didn't. No. No. Rather proprietary, that. Because it wasn't an Apple store per se, it was third party as it was. Damn thing was still what it was. But lo and behold, all the beer was being served in glasses. Yeah, Marty, 88 is the number 88 is special to neo-Nazis because it's the number of Heil Hitler. You can look it up. Idiots. Not you, them. And rather, I guess, foolishly or idiotically or I sat there, well, I went and got me one, and sat there at a table for a while just watching people get merrily inebriated on this festival weekend, drinking beer at a festival out of glasses as if nothing was out of the ordinary for that, and of course it wasn't. But for me, it was an epiphany moment because, you know, back here, we can't do that. In the time I sat there, I never heard a single glass shatter. I never saw one on the ground. Every time a beer was drunk, it was placed either on a table where it was picked up in short order, or it was placed back on the counter. It was amazing. Simply amazing. Because it's not something we would be capable of here. At least not anywhere that I've ever been. And it was far more sustainable. Speaking of sustainability, while I was there, the news broke that solar energy production in Germany had just crossed the 50% mark for the total amount of electricity produced in Germany for German consumption. Somehow that didn't square very much with what you hear from the fiends of coal back here in Appalachia that, well, you know, that solar is a nice idea, but it's, you know, technology really isn't here for that, out of that wind business. Yeah, that might be good. It might be working in about 100 years or so, but it's just not so. No, we're going to need our coal-fired electricity. We're going to need to keep on poisoning you dumb hillbillies. For our own profit, for about another 100 years or so until we got every last thing you got, and then we'll get out of the way, and if you want to sit in the sunshine or freeze in the dark, it don't matter a damn bit of difference to neither one of us. They are, of course, filthy liars. That 50% mark replaces the electricity that one would need 20 nuclear reactors to produce. Impressive, huh? Gosh, they must really have it together there, mustn't they? One would think, yes, but I took okay. So another one of the trips we took, on the way back from the Teutoburger Wald, and me getting to listen, and it just makes me, I gotta work on the language. It's wonderful. Because somehow looking at it, it was no longer the Teutoburger Forest. It really was. It was the Toyota Burgerwald. Because that's what it is. On the way back, we stopped in a little town called Wachendorf, not too far from where we were staying. Charming little village of middle size. Narrow cobblestone streets, steeply pitched, pointed roofs, half-timbered construction, straight out of a postcard. And we were going to go and have a bite of dinner, because it was asparagus season, and they go absolutely wild for white asparagus, understandably, as it is delicious. And I was going to try some of the local brew. Not swilling, trying. But on our way to pick out a restaurant, it was explained to me by Catherine and Birte, my friends, that yes, the Nazis were on the rise in Germany, and that it was particularly galling because they had gotten enough of a percentage of the vote to achieve federal election funding, so that the taxpayers of Germany were actually paying to support the nascent, resurgent NPD, otherwise known as Nazis. We were still getting to know one another, and I was proud to find out that they despised them. And they told me that the NPD came through Wachendorf and plastered their stupid little stickers on all the light poles, and then proceeded to ask me if I would like to join them in going and removing said Nazi stickers from the light poles, at which point I said, "Oh yes, do please." And so we did, as we walked around the town, removed Nazi stickers from light poles. But here's the funny thing. And I'm not calling anybody a Nazi except the Nazis, you know, and that's because they are. Here's the interesting thing. The stickers were translated for me, and every last one of them, if you didn't tell them that it was a slogan from the Nazis, would be any one of those principles that were set forth on those stupid little stickers would be right at home. Where? In any state or the National Republican Party platform. Let's see. I think I've got photographs of a few of them here. Let's have a look. Yeah. Here we go. And like I said, these were translated for me so that I could understand them. Oh, here's one now. Gute Geste kommen, gute Geste gehen. It is, of course, a photograph of a group of women with kerchiefs over their heads. Good guests come, good guests leave. Immigration. They don't like the immigrants. They particularly don't like the Muslim immigrants. These filthy little Nazis. That was one of them. Oh, yes. Global dient dem Kapital, sozial geht nur national. You can't be socialist without being nationalist. Get it? National socialism? Ever heard of that before? Yes, why, yes, we have. And then, this one. And all of these stickers are in blood red with black print and white fields. The image of what is either a bishop chess piece or, no, it's a minaret tower that is falling from the vertical to the horizontal. The sticker reads, Minaret Verbot. Unser Land in unserer Hand. minarets forbidden. Forbidden. Our land in our hand. Get it? Once again, remember the 9/11 mosque controversy? Of course you do! The not a mosque controversy? I went on when I saw the good guests come, good guests leave sticker. I couldn't resist telling them the story of Alabama and its miserable right-wing anti-immigrant law, and about the German Mercedes-Benz executive who had been told his papers were not in order and was hauled off to the Huskow. And a week later, the either Korean or Japanese auto executive who had had the same thing done to him. My new friends were a bit flabbergasted. But really, and I don't say this as some form of hyperbole, and I don't say this as some form of comparison to whatever went on between the 1930s to 1945 in Germany, really, there are Nazis on the march, on the move, growing in Germany. And they could sit down and talk policy with the Republican Party and not have a moment's disagreement. And that is the absolute God's honest truth. Rotten little bastards, all of them. But I felt a little, I guess, I don't know if patriotic's the right word or not, but I felt a little surge of pride as I got to help tear those stickers off those light poles. Because it was doing something. We went on to have a discussion about the NPD and the fact that they're publicly funded, and my friends were rather perturbed at that. They hated the fact that their tax dollars were literally funding effing Nazis. As I could well understand. And I was told that there is an internal debate going on inside Germany as to whether or not they should be publicly funded or whether they should simply legally be banned as a political party. And I said, my God, they're Nazis! How is there a debate? And it was patiently explained to me that there were some people who said, well, it's better to publicly fund them, that way we can control them. At which point I didn't, although I considered it, I didn't kick furniture. I didn't stomp my foot down. I didn't behave like any form of ugly American. I just looked across the table and I said, now, you know your history far better than I do, but I seem to recall a Paul von Hindenburg saying something about that he, as chancellor, he said, I will control this Mr. Hitler. And I didn't even like saying his name over there. I said, and that worked out how? And my friends both said, oh, yeah, we know, but it's hard to get people to understand that. Creepy. It's a lovely evening. As we... Oh, one other thing, and it was the Sunday of Memorial Day, and I had walked down to the festival. I decided to try the gyro. They serve it with a little bit of really mild sweet and sour. It's not like sauerkraut. It's like you get on a hot dog in New York. It's really kind of sweet and sour and delightful, along with the tzatziki and the gyro and the roll. Oh, wonderful. But I sat there having a beer and having my sandwich. And one of the bands there struck up a marching bandish kind of tune. And suddenly I had a another epiphany. You'll recognize it. Let's see if we can find it here. Yeah, this is it. So you get a sense of a little bit of the flavor of what I heard that day. And of course, that's Gary Owen. Long ago, the marching tune of the 7th Cavalry. It's what Custer's 7th Cavalry was playing as they marched into their demise at the Little Bighorn. And suddenly I realized it was Memorial Day weekend. And like I said, for the second time, tears came to my eyes because I realized I was probably the first in my family to be back on European soil like that, since two of my uncles had not come home. Now, the irony came in that the fact that the band was apparently giving us a twofer, because after it played Gary Owen, it fired up another little tune. And I recognized this, too. The singing wasn't there, but imagine it played by a marching band. That's the Panzerlied. And I kind of finished my beer off right quick and toddled on back down the path. That was a bit much. But Fred and Jimmy were very much on my mind because they were, of course, beloved to their families. And I was told repeatedly growing up how much I would have loved knowing them, because their memories were kept alive. Weird little moments of irony. Jim noting via email, he says, "My God, the triumph of the will is forbidden showing in Germany today." I don't know if it is or not. I mean, I'm not gainsaying you, Jim. But that Nazi propaganda. You know, they don't call themselves Nazis. They just kind of allude to it. and they take positions that Nazis would ordinarily take. And somewhere along the way, they got more than 5% of the vote. And 5% is certainly a starting place, and that enabled them to get money to fuel their campaigns. Yeah, they were. Yeah, Kevin, they were banned. This is not the Nazi Party, and they don't fly the Hakenkreuz. But they maintain all of the same policy positions. And their youth sit in black 88 t-shirts with their heads shaved, getting drunk at a monument to German unity. And it was really sad to see that, because so much, almost the vast majority of everything else I saw was such a magnificent display of functioning society, from a healthcare system that worked. There were some frustrations because the 1% are slowly dismantling that as well. To a meaningful retirement system, you know, so much of the social safety net that was put in place beginning in the late 60s by folks like Willy Brandt. And slowly but surely, people are trying, the right wing are trying to dismantle it, and the 1% are trying to dismantle it. Because, remember, they want it all. But my time in that magnificent old house where paintings of the original inhabitants still hung on the wall drew toward a close. And on Wednesday this past, we got in the car. Ha-ha! We headed for the Autobahn. And it was a delight. Another one of those little moments of reminders of the profound differences between there and here. Three lanes either side, slow-moving trucks in the right lane, vehicles passing the slow-moving trucks in the center lane, and the left lane reserved for quite often pure magic. We clipped along about 80 miles an hour, 100 miles an hour. But over in that magic left lane, periodically we would be overtaken in flashing microseconds by big, beautiful sedans or sports cars, you know, doing every bit of 130, 140. Phew, gone. At which point I was doing my best Jethro Bodine, just sitting there with my mouth hanging open, catching flies. Bang, would you look at that? But the driving was impeccable. No one passing on the right. No one with Ohio plates driving slowly in the left lane. Or, you know, pick whatever state that drives slowly in the left lane where you live. Here, you know, that's the norm. Because it's dangerous. And having it explained to me how much of a chore it is and how much it costs to get a driver's license. So, hence the degree of seriousness with which driving is approached, and we left our region and headed toward Cologne. And as we got toward Cologne, we veered off to the west, and we went to a tiny little village in an area of tiny little villages, in a little village called Bure. And there were other little villages around called Keppen. Kirpen, and a little village called Mannheim, not with two N's, but with one. Every one of those villages probably 1,000 years old. The geography as flat as a pancake. Absolutely, you could drop a marble and it wouldn't move. And this was where I got to see the dark underbelly of the predatory 1% in Germany. You remember me telling you about the 50% solar? Well, it turns out that 26% of the German energy market is still comprised of coal-fired electricity. Oh, okay, Bob. Yeah, that's better than the 36% that it is, 40% that it is here? Yes, absolutely. But if you go to Google Earth and you look up Buir, B-U-I-R, Germany, and then begin looking to its immediate left, you will see a vast, filthy, cancerous scar upon the landscape, and it's what they call open pit mining. Strip mining. Some several square kilometers and 1,400 feet deep, devouring the countryside to feed a coal-fired power plant that you can see pumping filth into the air on the far horizon to the west. And it's expanding, as it was explained to me by our local hosts. It will eventually, if you look at Buir on Google Earth, it will eventually come right up to the edge of that thousand-year-old village, and in the process will have consumed in its expansion a forest and five other villages. That flat topography where periodically there are stands of trees, and just topping the trees, you see the point of the spire of the village church. We drove through some of them. And they're going to be erased. Not for Germany's burgeoning coal needs, but for the 1%'s burgeoning and ever unsatisfied desire for profit. The power company owns the coal mine. It's called RWE, and they are predators. And they've gone 1,400 feet into the earth itself with these giant earth-moving machines. Every bit as horrifying looking as a drag line with great serrated teeth. The circular blades that gouge into the earth itself. And they've gone 1,400 feet deep to get to a layer of something that you probably already know about called lignite. And that lignite is there. And it's basically carboniferous mud. It's not even really coal. In the course of this visit, I was taken into the threatened forest, and I met there a group of young tree sitters who have built a little village of their own inside the forest itself. Taking cues, either consciously or from the description of the early church in which they said, "We held all things in common for the good of all," they've got a little clothing space there where people can take clothing that they might need. They've pitched tents. One guy has built a house in one of the trees and plans to build a series of platforms so that he can go from his house in the tree all the way to the little tree sitter camp and never have to touch the ground. And they are occupying this forest in the hope of stopping the destruction of that entire beautiful, beautiful area west of Cologne. And they took us up and showed us the edge of the strip mine itself. And I saw a series of pump stations in the ground. And I asked, "What are those?" And they said, "That's where they control the groundwater supply. They've already sunken pumps into the ground so that they can completely dry up the groundwater and pump it away at the flick of a switch." I said, "So you're telling me that they can dry up the water underneath this forest and just kill the forest at the flip of a switch?" And they said, "Absolutely." And it is planned that that forest that you can see on Google Earth will be gone this fall. And the continuous march of this cancer from this coal company will continue across that lovely, rich, fertile German agricultural space with those five doomed thousand-year-old villages in it. I met amazing people there. I met Peter and his son Max, who kindly hosted us and showed us what there was to learn, shared a meal with us. It was a joy to meet them because they are struggling. They are in this same struggle to save their towns, their homes, no more, no less than we are engaged in a struggle here, and my friends and colleagues out west are engaged in a struggle there. And we are building, and I think this is the important thing as we come to the close of this massive filibuster. I think this is the important thing to remember. We are coming to a place where we are realizing there is a way to beat these predatory monsters. And it is the realization that I've mentioned from time to time and time and again that our struggle is one and the same. Whether it is Eitan and his neighbors in Indonesia, or Peter and Max, and Boer, my good friends, my dear colleagues in Appalachia, my new friends out west in Wyoming and Missoula, and heading further west into Portland and Seattle. And one more friend that I would make at the Deutsche Bank annual general meeting there back in Frankfurt, where we gave our presentation, and a haughty, smug bastard by the name of Josef Ackermann, who is the toast and dear friend of Chancellor Merkel, told me that I simply didn't know what I was talking about. That Deutsche Bank would never do such a thing. He said, I come from Switzerland and we love our mountains, and people would be very unhappy with me there if I was financing the destruction of mountains. When in fact, we had the data in hand that showed that Deutsche Bank had given a revolving line of credit to Alpha Natural Resources, the single greatest practitioner of mountaintop removal in Appalachia. But the 1% do that. They just lie. They just lie. And there I met a new friend from India, who is engaged in the struggle there with a massive, vile, filthy coal company called Coal India that is hoping Deutsche Bank will fund them. And we had some conversation and we shared that idea that we are getting to the point where we can win because we are realizing that the struggle is the same no matter where you are. The struggle is not against a local coal company, but against the very idea of it being used to power the 21st century at the expense of people's homes, their families, and their lives. And so my profound thanks go out to my new friends at Urgewald, and my continuing thanks go out to those I refer to constantly as the hardest working, bravest people I know, Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, without whom none of this would have been possible. And there are still more stories to tell. But tonight I wanted to get the biggest part of the story told. And I thank you for your patience in listening to this 3-hour filibuster. Thanks to everybody who makes all this happen. The fact of the matter is, with me having been gone for 2 weeks in May, we are in desperate, terrible, awful, god-awful financial shape. We've got bills that are due right now that we can't pay. If you can help by hitting the PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com, it would be monumentally important. We very likely will, if we don't do something rather quickly, we will lose our toll-free service as of Wednesday, because fundraising fell to almost nothing at the middle of May, because, you know, there were no shows. But the effort continues, and it continues because of your determination. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go, our chat room moderators, Lottie and Sparky. Thanks to our news ninjas, Susan and Jean. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to John Fox. And thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. And though it's been a while since I've said this, it is nonetheless true. Always, always, always. Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.
With America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute past the hour and... Wow, I feel like after last night's program, my brain got turned inside out. I don't think I've ever done a three-hour filibobster before, but many of you responded to it positively, and I appreciate that. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is the Head On Radio Network, headonradionetwork.com. We like to call what we do here Conversation Radio. It happens 3 hours a night, Monday through Friday, beginning about this time. This time being 6 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're listening to the rerun stream at some other time, this is not live. But it's available to you. Well, it's a different model. A lot of people out there charge for what they do. God knows. Well, yeah. Anyway, no, it's available however you care to listen. It's available as a podcast at WhiteRoseSociety.org. And iTunes. The stream itself is available at iTunes Radio. And the stream is available at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. The stream is available at Tuner Internet Radio, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher Radio, and mercy sakes, lots and lots of other platforms of which I may not even be aware. If there's one you're aware of and I'm not, do let me know. You can listen at home. You can listen
via your smartphone. You can. That means you can listen in your car, going to work, coming from work, out running around, running errands. There's no place that the horn can't go or shouldn't go. And hopefully, in light of the fact, as I said, that last night was a three-hour filibobster, we will in fact engage in a little bit of honest-to-God conversation. You know, the conversation like in conversation radio. We'll engage in some of that this evening, I hope. Let's see. Where to begin this evening? I deliberately did not mention it until late in the broadcast last night. But we'll get started and get this out of the way, and hopefully, a word to the wise will be sufficient. We had four kind contributions last night during the program, and, I had a note from, Kate on the Front Range, after the show, saying that tonight was the last night, she said, tonight was the best show ever. You know, that's how we spell ever now, E-V-A-H. She also said for me to go on, because I have to be reminded from time to time, she said, drive home the notion that we are in a financial hole, which we are, and that we have bills that have to be paid by tomorrow, lest, among other things, the toll-free number go away. It's not for lack of paying the bills. It's for lack of having anything to pay the bills with. And that's where y'all come in, because this is all listener-supported. It is this happens because of your determination for this radio experiment to continue. Plain and simple. So, if you would like, and if you can, and that's, and note, you know, this is if you can, not you must. We're beginning June anew. And that means we have to raise. Well, we didn't raise it during the month of May, so we have to raise, we try every month to raise $2,500. We missed the mark in May, we missed the mark in April, we missed the mark in March, and we are getting ourselves into rather an ugly hole. And that, frankly, threatens the continued existence of the program from one month to the next, because that's how we operate, from one month to the next. I have been asked by Dr. John in New York if I would please on his behalf.